The Tom Woods Show, episode 736.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm doing a bit of a potpourri episode today. I think I called yesterday a potpourri episode, but that's not really true. There was a pretty obvious theme running through yesterday, but today, it's just a bunch of things I got, and let's see what sticks here. I'm going to play you in a little while an excerpt. Well, not an excerpt. I guess I'm going to play you the whole thing. An interview I did at the end of the Mises University program in July of this year, 2016, with an attendee. And you have to bear in mind, I was pretty tired. It had been a very intense week, and this was quite literally the very last thing I did at Mises University. But I just happened to find it the other day on YouTube, so I thought, what the heck? I don't even remember what I said. So I hope it wasn't too terribly embarrassing, because I'm going to just play it for you in a little while. But before I do that, let's cover a few other things. First of all, today I was thinking of doing an episode on left and right. What do the terms mean? Because I get a lot of people saying it's not helpful to divide people into left and right. There's no such thing as left and right. I'm sick of the left-right paradigm and this and that. And to some degree, I get that. Because I do think, to some degree, the left-right paradigms, I hate that stupid term, has obscured a lot, and it has divided people in a fairly cartoonish way in a lot of cases in modern America. But that doesn't mean that the terms left and right have never been useful or couldn't continue to be useful. I actually do believe there are such things as left and right. I absolutely believe that. And I think you can understand the world much more clearly if you understand the difference between left and right. Now, where libertarians fit into that, I also don't buy that libertarians occupy some ethereal space above left and right. I don't buy that either. I think there are, no doubt there are some aspects of libertarianism, frankly, that do come from the left. But I don't think it's helpful to view it as a leftist movement, ultimately. Now, that to some degree, that's some of my prejudices talking, I will admit. But I think if you understand what leftism fundamentally is, then the stuff I'm talking about in this show does not qualify. So at some point, I think I am going to hash that out and just talk about it. These are things we associate with the left. And this is why, for example, I can look at the Catholic Church and say there are leftists and there are traditionalists. And even there, you get people who say, there's no such thing as liberal or conservative Catholicism. There's just Catholicism. That's false. That is absolutely demonstrably false. There absolutely are people who are liberal, left liberal Catholics, and there are people who are conservatives or traditionalists. And because there are people who say, all you have to do is be Orthodox. There's no one, right, there's no liberal or conservative. There's just believing what a Catholic believes. But there's an orientation too. There's an orientation. There's a way you respond to the way you think about liturgy, for example, is conservative or liberal. Yes, you can, strictly speaking, hold all the absolutely required aspects of Catholic belief and still be a leftist when it comes to liturgy, and therefore be wrong about liturgy. So it's a total cop-out. And I'm going to just speak frankly. It's a cop-out by cowards who don't want to openly take a side to say there's no such thing as left and right in the church. There 100% absolutely is. So to heck with all that. And maybe I'll link to the episode I did with McCaffrey on the church. Why not? Let me get my notepad out here. You hear that sound? That's me flipping through the old notepad here. Episode 736. Let's put McCaffrey. All right. Now, do you realize this whole thing that I'm talking about here about left and right? This is the topic I just got done saying I'm not going to talk about. And then here I go, blah, 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 blah. Well, it turns out that to tide you over until I do get to this, episode 262 did cover this topic. What do left and right mean? Episode 262. So you can always head over to good old tomwoods.com/262 to think about that. And who knows, maybe when I do talk about it, I'll just be repeating episode 262. I hope my thought has evolved over time since we did that episode. Anyway, all right, what are we going to talk about today? Well, before I turn to the recording that I have for you where I say some rather radical things. I'm too tired at that point, too physically and mentally exhausted to be anything other than my normal radical self. So, before we get to that, I want to talk about an interesting piece I read just today over at Mises.org, and I will link to that. It's a piece by Jonathan Newman, whom we've had on the show, and Tate Fegley. And they have a piece called "The App Store Renders Government Irrelevant." Now, why do I find this piece interesting? It's not just because it mentions me, although that's actually how I found out about it, because when they link to one of my podcast episodes, and for some reason when people link to me, I get a notification about it. So I looked into it, followed it back, and I read their piece, which I hadn't seen yet. And what's interesting about it is, if you remember back to the episode where I talked to those scammers, I talked to people who were pretending to be from the IRS, and they were calling actually to empty my bank account, pretty much, claiming that I had neglected to pay my taxes, or I've been trying to defraud the IRS, or whatever. What episode was that? Episode 729. Anyway, in episode 729, I was dealing with these people who were trying to scam me, and I had a little fun with them, and I recorded the conversation and played it as part of the episode for that day. So if you didn't listen to 729, it's called "The Real Story of the EpiPen Fiasco, Plus Tom Takes on Scammers Over the Phone." If you skipped that one, oh man, you skipped a precious gem, my friends. You skipped pure gold, okay? I recorded that and put it on the show, and I even gave you the phone number so you can have some fun with them too. Well, what's interesting about this post over at Mises is that it shows how the private sector can deal with scammers like that when the government clearly is falling down on the job. There's no question the government is falling down on the job. So the Do Not Call Registry, for example, is a database of telephone numbers that telemarketers are not allowed to call and sell things to. But of course, the people who don't abide by federal law are the same sort of people who want to scam you out of your money. So these people don't listen to that. They don't scour the list of numbers they're not supposed to call. They just call. So the Do Not Call Registry does not stop somebody who wants to call anyway. So they've gone ahead and called me anyway. Well, it so happens there is a phone app for free called Mr. Number. And I will link to that at tomwoods.com/736 if you want to get it. Mr. Number blocks potential scam calls based on user reports. So in a way, it's kind of like, I think of it as being similar to those apps that you can use on when you're driving, and you can alert other people to speed traps, for instance. Well, this is in a way kind of like that. You're more or less alerting other people to the scam, that there's a scam that comes from this phone number. So Mr. Number blocks calls when enough of the app users flag it as a scam. Now, it's been downloaded, apparently, over 10 million times, which means they've got a significant database of telephone numbers that they can now protect you from, basically. Now, let me go through some of their piece. Compare this method to the FTC's, the Federal Trade Commission. If you get an unwanted call on your phone, you can go to donotcall.gov and file a complaint, which involves filling out a large three-page form with your personal information and everything you know about the caller. The form is probably dumped into a large database, never to be used or seen again. It's a very complex and useless process. Now, skipping ahead, Mr. Number is also a great example of the effectiveness of private enforcement of rules. If the government finds that people are not following its rules and it's a priority that those rules be enforced, it almost invariably responds by 1. Increasing law enforcement resources dedicated to detecting and arresting people, and or 2. Increasing the severity of punishment through higher fines and longer prison sentences. If it's not a priority, as the Do Not Call Registry appears to be, then the government does little to nothing. And then the two authors go on to say that a lot of people think that the state has a comparative advantage in rule enforcement because of its monopoly on force. But then they urge us to think about how few times when we're presented with the opportunity to commit a crime, we choose not to commit the crime simply because of our fear of being caught. And so they say that a relatively small amount of the order we observe is actually due to the government's use of force or threat to use force. So if, like Gary Becker, we model criminal behavior as just weighing the benefits of criminal activity versus the costs of any potential punishment, well, then you would expect us to be committing a lot more crimes than we actually do, because people don't just weigh things like that. Because as the authors point out, all of us can think of opportunities we've had to commit crimes. You could steal a package on somebody's front porch, or you could be walking by somebody's unattended garage full of valuables and walk away with some of them, knowing that nobody would see you. And yet we're not committing these crimes. And it turns out that actually something other than the threat of government punishment is keeping us from committing those crimes. Likewise, most businesses understand that they need their reputation. If their reputation is ruined, their business is ruined. So when it comes to law enforcement issues like that, we just tend to assume that we owe what peace and what civilization we enjoy to government and its threat of force. But as they argue in this piece, this does not seem to be as much the case as you would think, and that a lot of us are refraining from committing crimes for reasons other than fear of punishment. Likewise, there are a lot of not just things we avoid doing, but things we positively do that we're not strictly compelled to do. You're not legally obligated to leave a tip in a restaurant. And yet most people do it. Most people do it, and they're not forced to do it. The government does not force them to do it, and yet they do it. So I wonder, would the models necessarily predict that we would tip as much as we do, and as frequently as we do, and frankly, as universally as we do? Well, anyway, all this is basically just getting back to the idea that just assuming that government is the source of civilization, is the source of law and order, makes us tend to look to it for everything. And we overlook the ways that we in the private sector can manage our affairs, often far more effectively and efficiently than government can. And they conclude with, the second to last paragraph anyway, with this. This is another area where private efforts, especially mobile apps, have made use of decentralized knowledge to enforce rules in a far more effective way than brute enforcement ever could. Creative app designers have found innovative ways to solve problems and have rendered a range of government services either irrelevant or obsolete. Apps like Yelp probably have done more to ensure restaurant food quality than all government food safety inspectors combined. So a very interesting little piece, and I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/736. All right, now I'm going to play you, completely at random, by the way, has nothing to do with anything I just said, other than this excerpt and what I just said are vaguely in the direction of freedom. Here is my conversation with Cal Molyneux, and here we go.
Why is Austrian economics important to you?
Well, I think because it helps to understand how the world actually works, and because it's an area in which I think if you encounter it and read it and investigate it with an open mind, you find yourself virtually compelled to accept it because it's so convincing and elegant, even beautiful in the way it, one thing builds upon the next until you have this beautiful edifice of thought that corresponds to reality. Reality makes more sense with these tools. And most people, when they read economics, or if they read so-called mainstream economics, they don't understand what it is, or it seems to be too abstract, not connected to reality, too based on modeling. Whereas ours is relentlessly realistic. And that's why people respond to it.
Nice. And in this particular era, I guess, using Austrian in economics, you find it helpful, I guess, in applying to your study of history as well?
Yeah, I actually wrote an article for this Mises Institute's Journal, Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, called What Austrian Economics Can Teach Historians. And there are, of course, an awful lot of things can teach historians. The Austrian understanding of what causes the business cycle, for example, can help historians make sense of certain episodes in economic history. But also a correct Austrian understanding of, you know, national income accounting can help make sense of whether war really makes us prosperous or actually retards economic progress. You can make sense of what the economic performance numbers during a war are really saying. Not just look at them superficially, but look at them beneath the surface. So there are a lot of truths in history that are obscured without the key that Austrian economics provides you to unlock them.
Nice. And what do you think then of government, and should it be abolished?
Well, I'll say this. The state, the coercive apparatus that we are all familiar with, is foreign to the analysis that we read in the Austrian treatises by and large. Not altogether, but by and large. Because they, you know, if you look at strict Austrian analysis, it's about exchange, and it's about voluntary exchange. It's about production and interest rates and prices and profit. And all these things occur just spontaneously on the market. And there's no analytical reason to suppose that every service, every good, couldn't just be subject to the same analysis. There's no reason to take some out and say, well, these, we have to apply a different kind of analysis to them. In terms of abolishing government, well, I mean, that word, I think that people just misunderstand. I just think there should be a voluntary society. And there is such a thing as student government. I mean, that could be legitimate. In high school, you have a student government. Or, you know, there's the government of the chess club. You have your chess club president. As long as it's voluntary, you can call it what you want.
And then from there, what does a free market anarchy or anarcho-capitalism mean to you?
Well, it means... I want to say this in a way that doesn't insult people who don't agree with me. Because I have a lot of people I like and admire who do disagree with me on this, and I don't think they're all just stubborn dolts who refuse to listen to reason. I won't say it. Some of them are, but most of them aren't. But I would say it is just the consistent application of the same economic and moral principles you apply to all other aspects of your life. We apply the insights of Austrian economics across the board in all industries and in all times and places. And so what we're saying with so-called anarcho-capitalism is that if you're going to do that, if you're going to apply these economic laws across the board, if you're going to recognize that they apply across the board, then go ahead and apply them across the board already.
Right.
And likewise, if you're going to, especially if you're a conservative who talks all day long about we have to have absolute moral principles, okay, but again, that's what this is. It's saying that when we say you can't take others' things, we really mean it. We don't just mean it like 80% of the time or 98% of the time. We're going to apply that across the board and see, you know, see where it leads us.
Right, consistently, principally. Yeah. Nice. And then from there, I guess in your area of expertise and thoughts on, what do you think of secessionism then? All the way down to, I guess, individual secessionism.
Yeah, I will admit that I have a little... I'm a little bit more ambivalent about it than I used to be. Mm-hmm. In general, I favor all secessionist movements because I want, you know, the more decentralization there is, the greater the possibility that one or more locales will be attractive from a libertarian point of view. But the larger political units get, the less fewer constraints there are on them, because the ability for people to exit that political unit is constrained. If I have to fly, you know, or move 1,000 miles away to escape a particular jurisdiction, some people just can't afford to do that.
Right.
But if I have to move only 1,000 feet, that puts a check on them. So I generally favor that. But on the other hand, I have to admit there are cases where if I know that the seceding people are seceding because once they secede, their intention is to do great physical harm to a particular minority within their borders, it's hard for me to just say, oh, this is morally very clear. Of course, we always favor secession. I'm still working that one out,
But inherently, though, a lot of people think, well, there's going to be a lot of violence, but I guess we look like the eastern part of Europe when the USSR collapsed wasn't really violent at all.
Yeah, Norway seceded from Sweden. I mean, there are plenty of cases of peaceful secession. There's no reason for secession to have to be violent, no particular reason. It's just a decision that we want a borderline drawn in a different place from
right.
where it is now. There's no reason for violence with that.
Beautiful. And here in Rothbard's library, do you consider yourself an enemy of the state?
Yeah, I guess I do.
Well, thank you so much for being a champion of liberty, sir. It's been a pleasure being in your lectures and being part of the Mises Institute this summer.
This has been a wonderful week. Thank you very much.
All right, now before I let you go, I want to tell you that tomorrow, episode 737, I've already recorded it, it's ready to go, is one of my favorite episodes yet. And I went through a phase where I was saying that about a lot of the episodes, so people stopped believing me, but I don't say that just to have something to say. And I love tomorrow's episode on the general theme of America First, because Bill Kaufman has a book called America First. Where is it? Right here. Subtitle is It's History, Culture, and Politics. And he talks about some, not just the America First movement, but we do talk about that, but a lot of the literary figures in American history who were non-interventionists. And we get all the way to the 1990s. We have a little bit to say about the current election cycle. But it is fantastic because Bill, there's nobody like him. They really broke the mold with Bill Kaufman. And if you've heard him before, you know what I'm talking about. So please, please, please don't miss that. I want to tell you, especially for people who live in Iowa or are interested in Iowa, it's a site called deetsforiowa.com. Deets is D-I-E-T-Z, then the number 4, iowa.com. And it's a Tom Woods Show listener who wants to chronicle news in Iowa, which of course is a politically significant state from a libertarian perspective. But he's also talking about Iowa sports, all kinds of things revolving around Iowa. It's worth checking out. He's got a podcast that he's starting up. He's got several posts, but his aim is to give Iowa basically a liberty voice. And I know plenty of liberty people in Iowa, and I have no doubt that they would welcome the addition of deetsforiowa.com. So I'm going to link to that as the listener website mentioned at tomwoods.com/736. Remember, you get all kinds of goodies if you start your blog through my link. So before you get started, make sure and check out how to do that. tomwoods.com/publicity is the page for that. All right, tomorrow, one of my favorite episodes ever, and then if all goes well, Friday, which will be episode 739, we're going to do that debate on the creation of the State of Israel between two libertarians, and wow, is that going to be some hot stuff. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.